it back to where I was in New York, and apparently on Tuesday they have a meeting with all the talent coordinators and Johnny Carson, and Johnny said, well, I heard there was a guest on last night that everyone was talking about. If he was that good, why don't you see if he'd like to come out and do the show tomorrow night? I got on an airplane and flew all the way back out to California on Wednesday. This time there was a limo there to pick me up and drove me to the show. And I did the show on Wednesday night. I was on for about 5 or 6 minutes. And Johnny said, well, you know, we really didn't have very much time to get into this. He said, would you be willing to stay over until Friday? And we can continue the show and talk if you could stay over on Friday. And I said, no. I said, I'm sorry, but I've got screen doors at home that I have to be cleaned, and I've got important things to do. No, I didn't say that at all. And I stayed over on Friday, and I did the Tonight Show again on Friday. So now I had gone from not one single exposure on national television. I had just been touring the country myself. They decided to air the preempted show that aired, was supposed to air the previous Monday, on this Monday. And now I had 3 Tonight Show appearances in 4 days. In 4 shows. And that was the beginning of so many of the things that happened. And the first day out there, on the very first show that I was ever on with Shecky Green, the man who was the first guest on the show was standing outside a bank of telephones. And he was on the phone talking to his wife. And I was on the phone right next to him talking to my wife back in New York and telling her, you're not going to believe who's the first guest on this show. And she said, who? I said, here, listen. And I took the microphone and I put it right in his face. And it was Steve Allen. And I met him and talked to him and became a fan of his. And he became a fan of mine and promoted a lot of my books before he passed away recently. And it's that whole idea of if you get a picture and you can't let go of that picture, that the only thing you can do is act upon that picture. But it isn't just your acting upon that picture that is the essence of this particular principle. It is that something happens. As Patanjali put it, dormant forces come alive. Forces that are cooperating with you, that you can collaborate with. And when you begin this collaboration process, these forces begin to work with you rather than against you. Carl Jung called these forces, and this experience of having a collaboration almost with fate, he called it synchronicity. That is, that there is some kind of a synchronization that begins to take place with this power that you have to picture or to visualize or to create images, which is really an energy. You know, when you look at this thing called synchronicity, what we're discussing, what I'm talking about here is getting a picture that is so strong and then always acting as if you were already that picture. It's almost as if there's a time in your life when you have this thing called enlightenment, only it's through suffering. So that what you do is you have an experience, and 10 years go by, and then you look back, and you say, oh, now I know why I had to go through that experience. That divorce, that marriage that I was in that didn't work out, that business that failed, that illness that I might have had, that struggle that took place in my life, the whatever it might be, you look back on it and you say, I needed to go through that in order to get to this place. And the truth is, as I said earlier, every experience you ever had in your life, you had to go through in order to get to the next place, because the evidence is that you did. And that's all you need to know. You did. But that's one kind of enlightenment that is very, very troubling and very difficult, because you don't get that many 10-year periods. You know, you get four or five of those, your life is over. So you don't want to have to spend your life always having experiences, having these things come into your life, suffering enormously through them, continuing to attract more of that into your life, because all you're doing is getting to a place where you finally look back upon it, so your vision is always backward. It's always looking back and saying, oh, that's why I had to do that. Oh, now I understand. Oh, that's when I get it. And then you get to your deathbed and you say, I had to go through all of those things and all I got was to this place. But then there's another form of enlightenment in which while these things are going on in your life, while the struggle is there, while the illness is there, while the breakup is taking place, while the bankruptcy is in your life, whatever it might be, while it's happening, instead of you saying, I'm not going to anymore, wait a few years, and then look back upon this, instead I'm going to ask myself in the moment, what is it that I can learn from this right now? What is the lesson here? And you begin to open yourself up to, I'm going through this for a reason now, and I'm looking for the lesson, and so you use a different energy. You sort of connect to God or to this higher force, these higher, faster energies, in a way in which you ask for guidance now to get you through it so that you don't have to have all of this suffering that goes with it. All right? That's the second way. But that's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about a third way. This is called synchronicity. And synchronicity is where you don't have to have an experience and look back upon it, and you're not looking for the answer in what is happening right now. You are able to get out in front of your life, and you are able to see it coming before it arrives. And you are able to put your attention on something called intuition and insight. And this intuition and insight is available to you. And this intuition and this insight is the energy behind creativity, behind the process of creation itself. And so now you are always out here watching as your life is unfolding, and you have become the witness to it. But more than being the witness to it, you start to access higher energies and higher frequencies. One of the quotes and observations that I love from a woman I love very much, her name is Valerie Hunt. And Valerie has written many, many books. Brilliant woman, taught at UCLA for many years. And here's one of her observations. She said, we discovered that when a person's field reached higher vibrational states, he no longer experienced material things such as bodies and ego states or the physical world. He experienced knowing higher information, transcendental ideas, and insight about the ultimate sources of reality and creativity in its purest form. Thoughts became grander, more penetrating, and global. And all of this is the result of reaching a higher energy field. Now, in some of the earlier principles here in this program, I talked about energy moving from low to high. And the lowest energy is the world of form, and then the energy of sound, a faster vibration, then the energy of light, and the energy of thought, and ultimately the energy of spirit. And spiritual energy is the energy of love and forgiveness and peace and kindness and joy. So that when we are able to bring these higher, faster energies to the presence of the lower ones, they nullify and dissolve them. It's one of the ultimate principles that I'm attempting to get across in this program, that you have always got access to these higher energies, and they're only a thought away. They're just a thought away. And don't ever ask me how to do it. But I can show you. Is there anyone in this room and anyone listening who cannot get a picture of those airplanes flying into the World Trade Center? How many times did we see that on television after those events of the 11th of September? So just picture that. Just get that picture and of that building crumbling and those 3,000 or 4,000 people trapped inside. Just picture that. It's a very low energy picture, isn't it? Okay. Now change the picture. And instead of thinking of that and observing that, just get a picture of a dozen red roses in a vase with babies, bummies, or whatever it is, baby's breath. That white stuff behind it. And just get a picture of 12 long stem roses in a green vase with that little baby's breath behind it. Is anyone who can't do that? Anyone in the room or listening who can't change the picture from one of anger and hatred and terror to one of love and beauty? So my question back to you is, how did you do that? And the answer is, there's no one on this planet who can explain it. You just do it. You change the pictures. And when you do change the picture, you change the energy, and you change whether it empowers or weakens you, as I'll be talking about in the 10th principle. So, what I'd like to suggest about synchronicity is that there are various levels of connectors. That is how we are connected to things. If I were to have a little pull toy up here, and I had a string on the pull toy, and I were to take the string and attach it to the toy, and I were to pull the toy behind me, you would say, the reason that the toy is moving is because of the string which is connected to it and the energy that you are using to pull it, right? And so the connection between something moving that I am holding in my hand and understanding it is really quite basic and quite simple. It is just simply form to form connectors. This is why when you do this, this is what happens. Pretty simple and pretty easy and pretty basic. And then if I were to say to you, well, what about the connection between having a thought, which is invisible, and scratching my nose? And you say, well, that's actually pretty simple. You have a thought, and then you move your finger in a certain way until it reaches your nose, and you scratch it. And you say, the connection is between the thought and then the movement of your hand. And you say, well, that's actually pretty basic, but it's pretty complicated. It's pretty amazing that such a thing exists, because we don't know what a thought is. We know that we have a command center inside of our brain someplace, and we can find scientists who can tell us where that command center is, but there's nobody out there who can tell us where the commander is, who's in the command center. We can't find that with any of our instrumentation. But we still know I can have a thought. So there's a connection between having a thought and the action of that thought. And that's not too complicated, even though none of us can explain it. And then we have another kind of connector, which is a connector between my thought and the next thought. So that I'll be sitting at my writing table, and I'll have a thought about what I would like to write, and I'll start writing, and then I'll have another thought about what I'll do after I do that, and then I'll have another thought, and now I've got connectors that are existing between one thought and another thought. And we can't even find a thought, let alone the next thought, let alone describe what the connection is between the two of them, but there's nobody listening that doesn't understand that such connections exist in the universe, even though we can't prove them, we can't find them, they seem to elude us when we try to measure them. But there are still connectors between one thought that I have and another thought that I have. And most people can accept that and go through their life saying, yeah, I have this thought, then I have that thought, then I have another thought, and then I act upon that thought. All right? now the connectors start to become even more intriguing. And this is where Jung comes in, where he spoke about synchronicity. Because there is a connection between your having a thought and the form of another human being. Now, all of you mothers in this room, and all of you fathers who are listening, who have to be responsible when the mother is out of the house, or when you are responsible for the children, know, and I've seen it happen with 8 children, and I don't think I've ever talked to a mother who hasn't had this experience, in which they will have a thought that there is something going on with their child, and their child is in another room, or sometimes their child is in another part of the city. It happened with me on many occasions when I'd be out for dinner with my wife, and we would be having dinner, and suddenly she would get up and say, there's something wrong with, or the so-and-so happens to. And every mother that I've ever known has this connection. So many times, when my first daughter was born, when Tracy was born, and I was in my 20s, and I remember we lived in this house, and we slept on one floor, and the baby and Tracy slept downstairs, and we'd be up there, and I would be reading. I was working on my doctorate at that time, and my wife, Judy, was sitting, lying asleep next to me, sound asleep. I mean, deep sleep, that kind of breathing, REMs, rapid eye movements. I mean, this is someone who's out. And I would hear Tracy just stir in the other room, just stir. She was just turning. She could never have heard this. She didn't have those kind of ears. And suddenly she would get up and she would say, go check on the baby. And I'd say, wow, I was only in my 20s, but I thought this, what is that? There's a connection between one person having a thought and the physical activity of another human being. And now we're getting into the booga booga area. And is there anybody, how many mothers in this room? How many of you are mothers? Is there any one of you who are mothers that haven't had that experience? Is that like you've never had that? Now, there's maybe 30 mothers in the room, and every woman's hand went up and didn't go up when I asked if this was something that they had never heard of. Every mother knows about this, and every father does too. And now we get to even more bizarre kinds of connectors. And that is the connections between your thought and the thought of another human being. That is an awareness, and now we enter into what Jung called synchronicity. And everybody has these experiences of thinking about someone and having them on their mind, and then having the telephone ring, and perhaps you haven't talked to them for 4 or 5 years, and you pick up the phone, it's them, and when that happens, you go, whoa, booga, 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 what's going on here? I remember being at Madison Square Garden one time and having a thought about the guy. His name was Bob Doyle, and he was the chairman of the department that I worked at for years at St. John's University. And I was in Madison Square Garden, and I wanted to call him. And it had been 20-some years since I had seen him. So I left the university in 1976 with the publication of Uranium Zones. And this was now 1996, and I was speaking at Madison Square Garden. And I was in the lobby of Madison Square Garden, and I was on a payphone. And I remember he lived in a place called Garden City on Long Island. And I was going through, and I had him on my mind, and I'm going through, and I'm looking up the directory to try to find him. And I turn around, and guess who was standing there? No, it wasn't. It was Jim Schwartz. It was nothing. And there he was, standing there. And I thought, there's a connection between his presence there and my thought. This is something that is called synchronicity. And Patanjali wrote about it 2,300 years ago. He said, dormant forces come alive, and you can negotiate the presence of these energies when you are able to get a picture of what it is that you would like to attract in your life. And when you can't get that picture out, that is, you have that burning desire, you start cooperating with and collaborating with something that we just call coincidence. don't we? But remember the word coincidence. In mathematics, it's a term that defines angles that coincide. And in mathematics, two angles that coincide are said to be angles that fit together perfectly. And we have taken a term that means something that fits together perfectly and interpret it to mean that is something that fits together and shows up accidentally or in chaos. But actually, anything that is coincidental with something else is a fit that is perfect. And there are no accidents in this universe. When you begin to access a power, you start to have an awareness that it's absurd to believe that in a universe which has an intelligence behind it, that an accident could show up. Everything is a part of the perfection of it. Everything. There are no accidents in this universe. You came in when you were supposed to, you'll leave when you're supposed to. The children that came through you or didn't come through you are all part of that perfection. Questioning it, challenging it, all it does is keep you from accessing the ability to manifest and attract into your life what you really would like to have when you begin to question it. And when you ask, now the question always comes up when I talk about these kinds of things is, well, if there is a force, and this force is a part of the perfection and there are no accidents, at what point do I have a free will? And am I making any of these decisions? And Jung answered that question brilliantly. He said, at the same moment that you are a protagonist in your own life and you're making choices, you are also the spear carrier or the extra in a much larger drama. You are doomed to make choices. And that paradox is something you have to live with. Yes, you are making choices. Yes, you have the capacity to attract into your life virtually anything you want. And yes, there is an intelligence into which you can connect that can access virtually anything you put your attention on. And yes, it's all part of the perfection of the universe. Yes, both of those things you have to live with at the same time. You have to transcend those dichotomies. But I want to speak just for a few moments about what happens when you leave ordinary levels of awareness and you leave these lower energies. When you leave the energy of the solid, where all of your problems occur, when you leave that and move into this energy of spirit, wherein you only have love to give away, as I spoke about earlier, where your response to sadness is always a higher energy of joy, where your response to doubt is always a higher energy of faith, where your response to hatred is always the higher energy of love. When you practice what Francesco taught us in that very famous prayer attributed to St. Francis, what happens when you reach these higher spiritual energies is that you start to access something in which you can see it coming. And you get outside of yourself, as I just spoke about. And that is called intuition. And that intuition is available to you, that you can practice it virtually any time in your life, but you've got to get out of these lower and slower energies because it's not accessible there. It doesn't exist there. Problems exist there. Fear exists there. Worry exists there. Guilt exists there. Hatred exists there. Anger exists there. These are all lower and slower energies. And when you listen to the 10th principle, you'll see that they're not just lower energies, but they weaken us whenever we access them and whenever we use them. But when we get outside of them, we start to get out in front. And now I suggest to you, brazenly, that you don't have to have accidents in your life. That you don't have to be a victim of crime in your life. That you don't have to live in a world of scarcity in your life. You don't have to. If you're willing to take responsibility for whatever acts of crime have come your way without guilt, if you're willing to and just say, I own them, they're mine, I've attracted it for some reason. If you're willing to say, I have had these various accidents and I've attracted that into my life, I don't understand why, but I know that it's mine. If you're willing to say that I've attracted the wrong people into my life, people who have abused me and victimized me, and I have taught people how I'm willing to be treated, and I'm no longer willing to do that, and so I'm going to send out a different attractor energy. If you're willing just to take responsibility without guilt, I underline it. I don't want any letters, okay? I underline it. You do not deserve any of it. You are not being punished for the things that have happened in your life. You just own them. They're yours because you can't get past them if you're waiting for something outside of you to change. You get past them by taking responsibility for them. Then what happens is you start seeing an accident coming. And many of you have had that experience. When you are in a higher frequency in your life, and you have an intuitive sense that, I know it's a green light, but I think I better stop. You know, a lot of heads nodding up and down. And something tells you, whatever it might be, something tells you, I better stop and slow down here. And zoom, there goes somebody through a red light, and you stop, and you have that feeling that goes through. You go, what was that? What was that? And you know when you can access that? When you're close to God. When you're in fear, you can't access it. I've told the story of running one time. And the next day, I had to give a talk to a group of chiropractic physicians about how to avoid having accidents. And I stumbled while I was running. And I went into fat time, where I actually saw myself, because I was sprinting at the time in the last minute or two of my run, and I started tumbling and turning and twisting, and I landed on the pavement, and then my head turned and my arm, and I could feel the scraping taking place, and I could feel the cement and the asphalt on my head, and I came into the house. It was about 7 o'clock in the morning, and I went into the bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and I was a bloody mess. And I had little stones in my cuts and abrasions and so on. And the next day I was on my way to give a talk to a group of people about not having accidents. And I had all kinds of scabbing head up there. And there I was standing up in front of all of these people with scabs all over me and blood and bandages on my arms. And I told them that I know exactly when I had the accident. Because while I was running and sprinting in the last moment, I was having a problem with one of my children. And I was very concerned about her. And I was in deep fear that something very devastating was going to happen to her. And I was visualizing something terrible happening to her if she didn't change. And I saw that picture. And while I was in that lower and slower energy of fear and worry and anguish, I stumbled and I fell. And I attracted into my life the very thing that I was most afraid of. It's called the Job effect. And I could pinpoint exactly what I was thinking when that accident occurred. And I can think of other moments when I've been in moments of peace. There was a time when I was driving on my way down to Florida one time. And again, my little girl Tracy and her mother, Tracy and her cousin Kathy, were in the back seat of the car. And my wife was driving. And I was sound asleep, and I was in a very beautiful dream. We were in a Dodge Dart. Lime green. It was a bad energy just to be there in that thing. And I was sound asleep. And out of this deep sleep, and it was a very peaceful sleep, something woke me up. And I woke up, and I looked up, and I'm much taller than my wife was, and she was driving. And she couldn't see above the car in front of her, but there was a car passing on the wrong side of the road coming directly at her. The car in front of us swerved to avoid it, and here was a car coming directly at us that she hadn't seen before. And I just, out of this sleep, reached up, grabbed the wheel, and turned us off onto the side of the road. And the car went past. There was a driver sound asleep. And I hit the horn at the same moment. And that was 30-some years ago. and all of the work that I had to do, and all of the books that I had, and all of the purpose that I had for showing up here, the mission that was a part of my life, was not about to be undone by somebody falling asleep at the wheel. It just wasn't time. And there was something that was accessed. That's called intuition. You begin to sense there's trouble ahead. And so you look at a group of people that are standing on a corner and you think, that could be trouble. And your intuition says, run around them rather than next to them. And you run and you avoid that. And something tells you when you're walking out of a parking lot, there's some intuitive sense that says, I think I should have somebody accompany me when I'm doing this. And you listen to that intuition. Sometimes it isn't there and it's not necessary. When it's there, you pay attention. You begin. Synchronicity isn't any more confusing than the thought that exists between a mother and her baby. It's not any more difficult to understand than the idea of a remote control in your television set. When you sit there and you press a button and some invisible something that who knows what goes between that little button that you've pushed and that television set, there's something invisible taking place there that nobody can see with their senses, but we know that it's there. It's no more confusing than when we are driving along in our car and we turn on the button and music starts coming into our space. And if we want to change it, we push another button. And we can't see those energies, we can't see those connectors, but there is a connector that exists between pushing that button, the thought, I'll push that button. Now there's two connectors. There's the thought and the connector and then the button pushing. And then there's the connection between the button pushing and some invisible something flowing through some invisible place and showing up in the form of music. Who can understand that? And when we then have these synchronistic events in which we access our intuition, and what I'm suggesting is that when you reach these higher frequencies, intuition, insight, creativity, all of these things become negotiable. You can access them. You have the knowing. Because when you form a picture in your head of what you would like to attract into your life, you can begin to attract abundance and virtually anything else that you put your attention on. It's a law of the universe. Get that picture. See yourself as if you already are what you'd like to become. And every great artist, every great thinker is able to do just that. They have been able to see themselves as completing something. Do you know how difficult it is for so many people who get into a doctoral program? I think the statistics are that out of every 10 people admitted into a PhD program, one completes it. 9 out of 10 never complete it because they can't picture themselves writing a dissertation. They can get through the coursework and they can do all of that, but when it comes down to sitting down and doing the research and writing and going through all of what they call, you know, till you get to the very end, I'll never forget the day, they call it your orals. You know, that when you finally defend your dissertation orally and you're finally a doctor, and I always think that's after 3 years of anals, all right? Because they seem to be sticking it to you for 3 years. But the reason that I knew when I entered a doctoral program and was told that 9 out of 10 don't complete it, I already saw myself as having my doctorate. And I just knew that that was something that I had to do. And I suggest that there are people right in here, there are physicians in here, who probably entered medical school. There's a lady right here in the front who entered medical school. How many women who enter medical school complete the entire process and become medical doctors and have a practice? It's getting higher, but the statistics are against you as you enter something like that. But if you see yourself as having a practice, you see yourself as a healer, you see yourself as someone who is capable of becoming a doctor or anything else in your life, if you see it and get that picture, and I can't tell you, I try to teach this to my children, my daughter who wants to sing, I just said, sing. See yourself as a singer. Get that picture, and no matter what comes your way, don't ever let anybody ever tell you that it won't happen. You can let them tell you, and all you have to do is use that as a way to step into the gap, and then out of the gap, over here into the world of spirit, and bring that energy of knowing, that energy of insight, that energy of intuition. Are you listening, Jennifer? Because if you have that picture, there's nothing that can stop you. And you don't evaluate whether or not you are successful on the basis of whether people buy your CDs. That's the biggest mistake you could make. Or whether people read your books. Or whether people want to come and hear your lectures or buy your tapes. You don't do it that way. You evaluate whether or not you are a success by being one of those people who's on the road that's hardly ever crowded and enjoying everything that they do because they're seeing themselves as someone who couldn't be any place else. And you no longer find enlightenment through suffering. You no longer find enlightenment through having an awareness in the moment of what it is that you need to do to learn the lesson that's happening for you right now. You are now a person who's out in front of yourself, and you see it coming. And that makes you a master who lives coincidences, not in the sense of them being accidents, but having a perfect fit. John, how's your breath?
Okay.
Do you ever do any speaking, John?
That's fine.
You do very well. You've got a very nice command. And John's going to give us a little trumpet demonstration. Thanks, John. Thanks. remember what you heard is from someone who isn't supposed to have lung capacity and isn't supposed to be able to do those things. But you get that picture, as John said, more eloquently than I, as he came up here, because he's lived it. That when you get that picture and you treat yourself as if you already were what you'd like to become, you access whatever it is that you have a picture. It's the law that has to work.
My question relates to when you're dealing about the concept of synchronicity and getting out ahead of it and being open and intuitiveness, how does something as mundane as planning fit into that concept?
Right. No, that's an excellent notion. It's part of the duality that I was speaking about when I quoted Jung and about you're doomed to make choices. I think it was Spinoza once said that life is what happens to you while you're making other plans. And I remember Marianne Williamson once saying that God's plan works, yours doesn't. And all you have to do is get in sort of collaboration with God's plan. So that you do your planning and you set your goals and you do the things that seem important to you. But the key word is detachment. That's what I talked about in one of the earlier principles. It's always detachment, that you are not attached to the outcome. And remind yourself that if in your attachment to what it is that you think you would like to do doesn't materialize, it doesn't work out, you just you accept it and you move on and remind yourself that God's plan is working, you know. Yes.
Sort of piggybacking onto that, how do you make a decision about things like lawsuits? If you're faced with an issue and a lawsuit is a possibility, how do you decide if it's something you just move beyond or pursue?
You let go. You let go of the outcome. And if you insist on staying in it because there's a question of what you believe to be right versus what somebody else believes to be right, you work very hard at detaching yourself from all of the details and all of the information. In other words, you hire a very competent person who incarnated here to do those kinds of things, a lawyer, whatever. And you tell them that I don't want to hear any information that will weaken me, that will make me unhappy, that will bring me anger, that will bring me fear or whatever. You just keep all of that from me. Your job is to deal with this and to go after what it is that you believe, that, you know, to fulfill whatever it is, wishes you have. But you detach yourself from all of that. You go through your days being in a state of peace. And you tell him when he calls you, you only give me information that will strengthen me. I don't want anything that will weaken me. And you can do that. It's really quite simple. Yeah, sometimes there always will be some kinds of conflicts that will arise that you won't have agreement with someone else. But that's no cause for being depressed, miserable, unhappy, fearful, anxious, stressful. You just don't have to go there in your life. And I have lots of practice at that in my life. And I get better at it as I remind myself that I don't have to be attached to any of that. And when I have had some disputes that involved legal issues, I have told my attorney just exactly what I'm telling you now. I do not want you to call me with details that are going to be upsetting. Whatever it is, even if it's going to cost me money, write the check and keep me out of it. You go through your life and you don't have to have all of that. Any other thoughts or ideas? Yes.
Based on what you were saying yesterday, does that mean you try to love the person you're suing at the same time?
That's absolutely crucial. Truly it is. It's surrounding them with love. And most of the time, when you're able to do that, when you're able to surround them with love, you can you can make it go away. You'd be surprised how often. Well, you remember the story of Ruth Carrico that I read, you know, while she was, I mean, what could be more hateful than that? And she was practicing loving someone that was trying to kill her. And it's again, it's the lesson of our greatest spiritual teachers. If we want to call ourselves people who are devotees of the greatest spiritual teachers who ever walked among us, we have to practice what it is that their lives were and what they were teaching us. Okay. This ninth principle I call Treasure Your Divinity. I'd like to open this with an observation from an essay written in 1841 by Ralph Waldo Emerson. The essay was called Self-Reliance. Probably the most important, certainly the most recognized essay that Emerson wrote. He said, "A man should learn to detect and watch that gleam of light which flashes across his mind from within, more than the luster of the firmament of bards and sages. Yet he dismisses without notice his thought, because it is his. In every work of genius, we recognize our own rejected thoughts. They come back to us with a certain alienated majesty." What he is saying here is that we shouldn't be paying so much attention to the bards and sages and all that has been written, but indeed that we should look within at our own thought and not reject it just because it's our own. Valerie Hunt spoke about this in The Infinite Mind. And she said, "The thing that is the most troubling for most people is not only that they don't treasure their own divinity, but they're terrified of it. Because they have been raised to believe that that which is divine is separate from who we are. That God, or spirit, or whatever it is that we want to call this force, is something that is outside of us. It is often something that we pray to. And we ask in our prayers for this being, usually it's a male, usually it's a white male, a white dead male, that is circulating around in heaven someplace. And it's like this huge slot machine in the sky. And we ask of this white dead male in the sky to provide for us the things that we are asking for, and we pull a lever, and hopefully we'll get more than one or two cherries. And that has become sort of this accepted idea of what it is that is divine, that divinity is external to ourself. You know, in the Course in Miracles, they use the word problem twice. In the first case, they say you don't have any problems, though you think you have. And I've addressed that already. And I wrote an entire book about it called The Spiritual Solution to Every Problem. The second place that they mention the word problem is where they said, if you do have any problems, you only have one. And your problem is your belief that you are separate from God. Your belief that you are separate from God. And it goes on to suggest, and I have elaborated on this at length in this program and in the other places where I've written, suggesting that it was only when we separated ourselves from God that we took on something called problems. And as we began to separate ourselves from God, we took on something that is called, of course, this thing is called the ego. And the ego isn't It isn't anything that you can just check into a hospital, say, look, my problems all stem around this thing called ego. I would like an egoectomy. Just remove it, please, and then I will be fine. The ego is just an idea that we carry around. And we carry around this idea, and the idea has these six components, which are that I am what I have, I am what I do, I am my reputation, I am separate from you, I am separate from what I would like to attract into my life, and I am separate from God. Those are the six components. And we carry around this idea of being separate, and I am my stuff, and my achievements, my acquisitions, and all that I've accomplished, and what others think of me. And when we took this on, we separated ourselves from our divinity, which we can never be separate from, except in our minds. And in our minds, we began to use our minds in such a way that we created all of these things that we now come to call problems, and many suggest that we even call diseases. That our diseases that we experience in the world come about as a result of the way that we think. We know that our thoughts can create diseases. We know that we can raise our blood pressure by the way that we think. Certainly we know that an ulcer has something to do with the way that we process events in the world. That this physical thing that shows up in our body is related to the kinds of ways that we stressfully process our life. So that who knows, heart disease, cancers, arthritis, cystic fibrosis, whatever it might be, collectively have something to do with the fact that as a species, we have separated ourselves from the perfection into which we were created. And balancing, an energy medicine is going to be a way of rebalancing ourselves so that we can learn to live in harmony with these things that are now destroying us. It's a possibility. It's a potential. It's just having a mind that's open to that possibility. But the other things that we have done when we took on this thing called an ego, we have found a way to process virtually everything in terms of our form, our flesh, our spirit. We have left out of the equation. And I'd like to suggest, of course, that treasuring your divinity is nothing more than recognizing that it was perfection that you were born into. One of the other observations that was made by the transcendentalists is expressed by Emerson. He said, the transcendentalists believed that a perfect God would not create imperfection. And thus, man is inherently good, not bad. But we haven't been really raised that way. And further, they believed that they were armed at birth with God-given tools, such as a conscience, to help us to attain the divinity they believed Christ, in the example of his life, promised us. They saw God expressed in nature and in the soul of each and every individual. That a God that is perfect, a God that is divine, would not be someone or something that would be about creating imperfection. That we are perfect creations. And the idea that we were born into sin and that there is something wrong with us and we are constantly in a battle to overcome the inherent badness of our creation is something that the transcendentalists rejected, and I do as well. That God is good. In Psalms it says, be still and know that I am God. In the stillness you will know that. So that treasuring our divinity is really treasuring our value. And one of my favorite poets is a man named Rabindranath Tagore, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1927, I believe, for a collection of poetry called the Gitanjali. And in this collection of poetry, he suggests that in a conversation with God, Krishna, he puts it this way. making a distinction between the part of us that is the ego and the part of us that is divine. He said, I went out alone on my way to my tryst. But who is this me in the dark? I step aside to avoid his presence, but I escape him not. He makes the dust rise from the earth with his swagger. He adds his loud voice to every word I utter. He is my own little self, my Lord. He knows no shame. But I am ashamed to come to thy door in his company. There's a part of us that wants to make the earth rise with our swagger, that adds our loud voice to every word I utter. There's a part of us that wants to be right, that wants to make everybody else wrong, that wants to judge others, that wants to believe that I am superior to others on the basis of how much stuff I have, or how much education I have, or what religion I happen to practice, or where I happen to live, on which side of the boundaries. That part of us is not treasuring our divinity. That is the ego. And while I don't think that it's very possible for most of us to ever completely get rid of this ego, as long as we're incarnated into a human form, I do believe that it is possible for us to tame it and to make it less of a dominant force in our lives by no longer having such an important role placed on being right and making other people wrong. One of the ways to begin to work at treasuring your divinity is to practice being kind rather than being right in as many occasions as you possibly can. And you have lots of opportunities to do this on a daily basis. Thousands of them show up in little tiny interactions in virtually every place you go, with strangers, with your children, with your spouses, on the telephone, ordering something in a restaurant, whatever. There's always this part of us that is the ego that wants to be right, that wants to make someone, wants to make the dust rise from the earth with your swagger. And you know, after a while, you start noticing it. You start observing it. As your own ego becomes less and less of a dominant force in your life, you start to notice how much other people's ego is playing such a role, how much strutting there is, how much posturing there is, how much bragging takes place. You can see it in body language. You can see it in the way that people deal with each other. You can see it in lines at the grocery store. You can see it when you're trying to get your ticket straightened out at the airport, whatever it might be. There's this placing somebody else in a position of inferiority, and you are here to do this for me, and I'm more important than. And it isn't said that way, but it's sort of communicated. And you think to yourself that all of these people, I do it all the time, all of these people are nothing more than me in an earlier time in my life. That this is the way I was. I see it in my past relationships. I see it in the way that I dealt with my children years ago and the way that I deal with them now. I see it in noticing that it's easier now for me to be kind and to suspend being right. And I'm right almost all the time. But I no longer need to point it out, except for right now, of course. But the idea that even if you know that when you're talking to someone that they're completely wrong, if you can suspend the need to point it out, and instead just say something kind back in response, if you can just practice doing that wherever you are, those are points towards treasuring your divinity. It's not about worshiping more. It's not about getting down on your knees and practicing somebody else's orthodoxy. It's not about fitting in. It's not about memorizing verses out of the Bible or the Quran or the Torah or whatever. It's not about that. It's about practicing being Christ-like rather than Christian. It's about practicing being Buddha-like rather than Buddhist. It's about practicing being Muhammad-like rather than Muslim. Muhammad said, don't even harm any tree that has a green leaf growing on it. If there's a green leaf growing on it, don't harm it. Practice that. That kind of love and admiration for humanity. Live as much as you can those principles. And all it amounts to is simply beginning a process of moving out of the lowest levels of consciousness. The lowest level of consciousness is ego consciousness. Ego, some have suggested E-G-O, is an acronym for edging God out. That as you edge God out of your life, what you have done is you have separated yourself from your divinity, believed that you are those six things, separate from everyone, separate from what you would like to attract into your life, separate from God, all of your possessions, all of your achievements, your reputation. You start believing that this is who you are, and you start living this way, and you look upon your divinity as something that is out there that you'll see, you'll talk to on at the synagogue on Saturday or at church on Sunday morning or whatever. And you'll practice during certain days, like we call, you know, at the end of the year, 30 days of fasting, and this makes me, you know, closer to God and so on. To me, it's about applying the principles of moving past ego consciousness. And then we move into the next level of consciousness, which is called group consciousness, which causes almost as much trouble as ego consciousness. And this is where we begin to identify ourselves on the basis of the groups that we belong to. And we believe that if we were born into this group, that that group is superior to the other group. And if we were born on this side of the river, and you were born on that side of the river, that makes you my enemy in the event of a boundary conflict or a cultural conflict. And if I am American and you are German or you are Japanese or you are Taliban or whatever, then that makes me someone who has to be opposed to you. Whenever I hear the song God Bless America, I always have a part of me, as Valerie Hunt speaks about, you begin to think globally rather than locally. I always think, I'll be glad when the day comes when it's God bless humanity. When there's no exclusion anyplace. That God just isn't on the side of those of us who happen to live in this particular location. Which is not in any way to suggest that America isn't a wonderful and a beautiful place. I'm honored and thrilled and privileged to live here, of course. But honoring your divinity means thinking more globally. And when I see conflicts between one group and another, men versus women, when I see conflicts between people who are older and people who are younger, when you see conflicts existing between people who have one color skin and a different color of skin, when you see conflicts between people who wear a robe versus those who wear a yarmulke, when you see all of these divisions, and there are just endless numbers of them that we pigeonhole ourselves into, they are still the cause of virtually all conflicts on the planet. We still are dividing ourselves. We don't understand that this is a round planet. And on a round planet, there's no choosing up sides. There are no sides. So the third level of consciousness in which you begin to treasure your divinity is the level of unity consciousness, mystical consciousness, God consciousness. This is the level at which you begin to see that we and everyone is connected to everyone else. Let me share something with you from Power versus Force. Pain exists to promote evolution. Its cumulative effect finally forces us in a new direction. Though the mechanism may be very, very slow, how many times is it necessary, he asks, to hit bottom before a lesson is learned? Perhaps thousands. Which may account for the sheer quantity of human suffering, so vast as to be incomprehensible. But slowly, ever so slowly, by inches, does civilization advance by inches. And as many times as I was interviewed on TV after the events of the 11th of September 2001, when people ask me about my view of humanity and do these kinds of things suggest that we are moving backward or forward, my suggestion is always that we are moving forward. And that these kinds of events bring out in us the very best that humanity has to offer, as difficult as it is for us to see in the moment. And I think back to not too long ago. In 1958, I was in the United States Navy. I was in a radio school there in a place called Havre de Grace, Maryland, Bainbridge, Maryland. And my best friend in life at that time, who was in the boot camp with me, was named Rayford Secondus Dudley. I always hope that if I mention it enough that I'll get in contact with him, because I've lost contact with him. And he was black, young man from Chicago. And it was 1958. And we walked into a diner in Havre de Grace, Maryland at 1 o'clock in the morning. And we were both in the uniform of the United States Navy. And they wouldn't serve us because he was black. In 1958. And I walked out of there in shock that a man who was serving his country and in the service could be denied to have an omelet with me. And we both, of course, walked out. And I think back to 1958, and now it's 40 or so, 45, hard to imagine, years have passed. And that kind of thing is impossible in this country today. Just doesn't happen. Inch by inch, slowly. There was a term that was being tossed about called ethnic cleansing in the Balkans, in Kosovo, and in all of the places like Herzegovina and all of those places that became so popular in our geographic consciousness, Bosnia, places we hadn't heard of. And there was a man named Milosevic who was accused of attempting to rid the planet of a certain ethnic group. And the world's outrage became very apparent. And there was a coalition like none we had ever seen before formed from people all over the world, through the United Nations and through NATO, and even through the Far East. And this was brought to a halt before it could get too far out of hand. And I think back to the Holocaust, just 40 or 50 years before that, when I was a little boy, when ethnic cleansing was something that the world turned its face away from, so they didn't have to look at it. When we knew it was going on, there was not a big secret. Inch by inch, slowly, mankind moves toward a higher level of consciousness. I remember in the 1960s when we were exploding nuclear devices in the United States, underground and even above ground, remember? 200 and some of these things that we're just going to take a 50 megaton bomb, put it underneath the ground and explode it, and it won't have any impact on anything underneath the ground. 50 megaton bombs. These are bombs that would make Hiroshima and Nagasaki, look like firecrackers. They use these kind of bombs, those kind of Nagasaki bombs, as fuses now on the kind of bombs that they've created for mega death. And then 30 or 40 years go by and we move more slowly, ever so slowly, away from nuclear proliferation, until we get to a place in our consciousness where the outrage of even having these weapons existing becomes the focus of most of our attention politically. And disarming is much more important than what we're going to do with them and how can we destroy them and so on. And then France decides in the South Pacific that they are going to explode an underground nuclear device. And the whole world's outrage becomes apparent. And there's a boycott of everything French. No French wine, if you do this. No more French bread, French pastries. Outlawing French kissing, it's gone, we can't have that. And the world became very upset and forced us to look at inch by inch how we are growing rather than going backwards. And there are many, many more examples. One of my favorite is getting on an airplane out in Wyoming, and a woman's voice came over the PA and announced that she was the pilot and that she was flying us to our destination. And a man was walking through the aisles asking if we wanted coffee, tea, or milk. And I thought, now there's an example of transformation. And when I graduated from high school, the number of women that were admitted to law school and medical school was somewhere around 1 or 2%. And now it's somewhere around 50%. Slowly, inch by inch. And when those planes flew into the World Trade Center, it brought out the very best in millions of us, not only in America, but around the world. And I believe what Hawkins is speaking about, that we have to treasure our divinity by remembering that our basic inherent goodness is what is in there. He says, that which is injurious loses its capacity to harm when it is brought into the light. And now nothing need remain hidden. Every thought, every action, every decision or feeling creates an eddy in the interlocking, interbalancing, ever-moving energy fields of life, leaving a permanent record for all of mankind and all time. And he says this even further, in this interconnected universe, now we're talking about the highest level of unity consciousness, God consciousness, divinity consciousness. In this interconnected universe, every improvement we make in our private world improves the world at large for everyone else. We all float on the collective level of consciousness of mankind so that any increment we add comes back to us. And simple kindness to oneself and all that lives is the most powerful transformational force of all. It produces no backlash, has no downside, and never leads to loss or despair. Every thought is in a permanent record of all of mankind. And ever so slowly, we move. Thank you.